Yeah, first of all, can I thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak here. I've been the statutory Scot on many meetings and many committees for a long time, and also I'm retired, so I've no particular axe to grind. Basically, I'm a pure scientist at heart. I did a degree in botany at the University of Glasgow, and botany was certainly not regarded as a macho subject in Glasgow at that time. And the professor of botany, who was a paleobotanist, he looked after fossil plants, he said on the last lecture of the last day of a four-year course, he said, there are living plants as well, but we don't have time to consider these. So I didn't learn very much about higher plants. I then decided to do a PhD. It was not directed in any way, but it was influenced. It was influenced by the subject. It was influenced by the supervisor. It was influenced by pride. But I was never directed. I was given my head to do whatever I wanted within the broad subject area. And maybe that was a problem, or indeed perhaps that was a making of me as a scientist. I then decided to do a PhD. And again, I was given complete freedom. I wasn't directed. I decided to study a group called the cyanobacteria. And I decided to look at their taxonomy. I couldn't see anything down the microscope but a little blob. And, I got into terrible difficulty. And then I did what most people do. At that stage, research students do. They write to the world's expert, who was actually in California. He didn't reply for about 6 months, and I thought that was the time it took professors to reply to correspondence. But then I got a letter back which said, "Dear Mr. Stewart, I'm extremely interested that you're working on cyanobacteria. I'm no longer working on these. I've had a nervous breakdown." So at that stage, I could actually have been doing with some direction. But nevertheless, I went on and did a PhD, and again I got complete freedom to do it. And the aim then was to do fundamental science, because the next stage after getting a PhD and getting a job as a university lecturer was to get into the Royal Society. So how do you get into the Royal Society? By doing basic research, publishing your 90-odd papers, Martin, is it? I think Einstein published two. And once you got that, then you say to yourself, that was quite an important aim in life, and it stood me in good stead. But then, in the late 70s, I suspect, science became directed more subtly by the research councils. They wouldn't give me money for this. They wouldn't give me money for basic science. They wanted me to, they would give me money for something which was very directed. And I regard the 70s as the dark ages of scientific research in recent times in the UK. Very specific projects, get higher plants to fix nitrogen, and we'll give you a grant for 2 to 3 years. Or if you're lucky, we might give you one for 5. Regular 6-month reports. Most of the decisions in the research councils were taken by redundant scientists who couldn't do the research and found their job as administrators. And then they tended to dumb down science. So I think that actually held science back. And I know that's in the short term. It became apparent, however, to me, at that stage, that there were key problems, world problems that needed resolution. The environment, agriculture, the economy, health, quality of life. And then it became appreciated that most of the solutions were science and technology based, which they are. Also that the UK did about 5% of the world's research, and the research base of the world was expanding sort of exponentially. And there were a plethora of labs across the world all doing the same thing, and the UK couldn't compete in everything. So let's the next point was then, so let's use science to give us competitive edge in key areas that would make a difference to this country. And basically that's what led us into technology foresight. It directed scientists not into producing plants that fix nitrogen in 3 to 5 years, but what were some of the broad areas that were of importance to the UK. Whether it was on the economic side, and there was a large focus on the economics, whether it was on environmental side, or whether it was social influence. And within that broad area, if you can't do everything, you've got to decide which broad, it's possible to decide which broad areas that might be of importance to the country. And then you say that within these broad areas, you give scientists their head to find out, to make discoveries which might benefit that particular area. And the other advantage, of course, was that if you said what you were doing was of economic advantage, the government might actually give you some more money, and that would help even the most basic of scientists. So I became totally convinced that science and technology had much to offer, not in 100 years' time, but over the next, 10, 15, 5 years' time, that the taxpayer should not be paying for everyone to do a PhD, irrespective of the quality of the PhD. I mean, it seems to me totally wrong that anybody who gets a 2-1 or a first should then get a grant from the government to go and do a PhD and be supported by the taxpayer for the next 40 years to do what they like. And also, I wonder about this thing that we've got about Nobel Prizes. I wish I had one, but I've not. And I'm probably too old to get one. But I think, we emphasise Nobel Prizes, 15 Nobel Prizes here at the Royal Institution. Nobel Prize is costing the UK taxpayer about £20 million per Nobel Prize. Is that a good use of resource? Or is it not a good use of resource? And I think the public has got to sort of perhaps judge that, because it's a taxpayer who's paying for it. I do believe, however, that the very best scientists should be given freedom to carry out the research. And it's better, of course, if they work at a university where there's a lot of private resources available for them. For the bulk, it would be better, I believe, for them to be broadly directed, broadly influenced by what they can do for the UK, whether it's by spinning out new companies, whether it's by improving the environment, whether it's producing agriculture, whether it's producing better agricultural crops. And if we can't do that, then I question the extent to which the taxpayer should contribute. Thanks.